As to the best of our knowledge, I'm Anne Strangechamps.
And I'm Steve Paulson. If you've been following the news about psychedelics, you know we may be on the cusp of a revolution in psychiatry. For the first time in decades, promising new treatments for depression and PTSD seem to be just around the corner.
But psychedelic therapy is not going to be like anything we've known before.
When I could feel the medicine taking hold, there was a feeling of like a big feathery wing swooping over me. It was like, ooh. I felt like I was swooning in it.
Blissful highs, but also weird hallucinations.
And the plants were going, me, 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 come pollinate me. And they were talking to the bees, but they were talking to me too.
I felt like I was moving on a conveyor belt into a jungle, and what it was leading to was a huge wasp. And I'm like, oh, I'm going into a wasp.
I suddenly found myself surrounded by these enormous fluorescent serpents that started speaking to me. A kind of telepathic language that went right through my forehead. And the first thing that they said was, you are just a tiny human being. And I could see, looking at them, that they were right. At which point I had to vomit, in fact.
It can all be a little much.
In a sense, I'm grateful I had this experience, but it's totally terrifying. The last thing I remember is that, holy shit, what have I gotten myself into here?
Frankly, a lot of you may be listening to this and thinking, yeah, no thanks. And speaking as someone who spent more years of my life on antidepressants than off, I might be with you there. I mean, sure, I would like to feel better. But does the treatment have to be quite so epic?
And that's one of the biggest questions about psychedelics today. What if you need the benefits of psychedelic therapy, but you don't actually want the journey that shakes your world inside out? Is there a way to take the drug without the trip?
This is Luminous, our series on the science and philosophy of psychedelics. And this hour, the debate over the drug, the trip, and the future of psychedelic therapy.
So I've been following the development of psychedelic drugs for years, and I've talked with lots of the scientists who've done really groundbreaking research. It's pretty clear these drugs have tremendous potential for treating all kinds of mental disorders. And then last year, I heard about a scientist who's trying to do something that seemed so radical, so counterintuitive, it was hard to fathom. He's trying to re-engineer psychedelic molecules to remove the trip. And he co-founded a biotech company that's raised well over $100 million to develop these drugs. But still, you have to ask, who wants to take a hallucinogen without the hallucinations? Isn't the trip the whole point? David Olson is a neuroscientist at UC Davis. He's not claiming that a psychedelic journey won't be helpful. He is saying we need to recognize the true scale of the problem.
1 in 5 people will suffer from a neuropsychiatric disease at some point in their lifetime. That's about 1 billion people worldwide.
And psychedelic-assisted therapy, he says, is just not scalable at that level.
It needs to be administered in a clinical setting under the supervision of usually multiple healthcare providers, which drastically increases the cost and the complexity of the treatment. You know, for some people, they're not going to have access to that kind of care. They can't afford to take off the 6 hours of work for their psilocybin session. They may not live near a psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy center. Their insurance might not pay for it.
And even if you manage to get over those hurdles, even in the best-case scenario, a lot of people are never going to get this therapy.
Let's assume that there is a psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy center next to every Starbucks, and let's assume that every insurance company will fully reimburse for it. There are still a lot of patients that will be left out. If you have a co-occurring condition like schizophrenia or a family history of psychosis or dementia, you may not be a great candidate for psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. Additionally, there are some cardiac risks associated with some of the various psychedelics. And so if you have heart condition, you may be excluded as well. And so I'm concerned that these types of medicines will not be broadly available to the general population.
And there's one other thing. A lot of people just don't want to have the trip.
That's true.
I mean, the psilocybin trip can be very scary. Even if it's beneficial, it can produce a ton of anxiety. It can make you feel like you're going crazy. It's not for everyone.
Agreed.
There's a big question underlying your research here, and that's if we want the therapeutic benefits of psychedelics to treat some of these disorders like depression and anxiety, I think the operating assumption has been it's all about the experience. It's all about going through this mind-bending trip where you kind of see the world in new ways. You know, you have this new sense of meaning and purpose. You have maybe sort of the sense of being connected with the universe. That's why the therapy works. That's why psychedelics work. You're talking about something totally different here.
Well, there's been a lot of really great research from people like the late Roland Griffiths and others who have demonstrated that a psilocybin experience can be rated by people as being among the most significant experiences in their lives. But if there are other patients that do not need that experience and can get benefit by just having physical changes in the structure of their brains, then that would broaden access to a larger number of people.
And that's why David Olson's trying to engineer new kinds of molecules without the hallucinogenic trip. He says the prefrontal cortex, that part of our brain that regulates our thoughts and actions and emotions, can get out of whack. The neurons atrophy, which can then lead to all kinds of problems, including depression, PTSD, and schizophrenia. So what if you could repair the prefrontal cortex?
The way I would describe it is if you think of a neuron like a tree. Trees have branches that would be like the dendrites of a neuron. And on those branches, there are leaves, and those would be like synapses in a neuron. In a healthy brain, you have a very rich canopy where you have lots of these leaves touching each other so that you have lots of communication between the trees. Squirrels can easily jump from one tree to the other. But in many brain disorders, it looks like wintertime. All of the leaves have fallen off, the branches have been pruned back, and now there's not easy access between the two trees. And so what these psychoplastogens seem to do is to rapidly regrow the neuronal arbors and reestablish that synaptic connectivity.
My understanding is this is different than the basic premise of SSRIs, where it's really trying to fix a chemical imbalance. I mean, it's basically trying to give you more serotonin, which will then improve your mood and hopefully treat depression. This is a totally different model that you're talking about.
So SSRIs definitely work for some patients, for sure. But they don't work for all patients. And the other thing about SSRIs is that daily administration paradigm has other disadvantages. If you take any drug every day for a long period of time, it is quite likely that you're going to have some kind of off-target side effects. Things like weight gain, sexual dysfunction are very common with SSRIs, and they can lead some patients to not want to take them for those reasons. And so if we can identify molecules that can do what an SSRI does over the course of 3 weeks, but they can do it after one dose within 24 hours, and the effect would last for a month, that would allow patients not only to have a rapid response and a sustained response, but potentially avoid a lot of those undesired side effects.
David has a name for these small molecules, psychoplastogens. They're drugs that generate new plasticity within the brain. firing up those synaptic connections that had withered away.
So are these essentially like classic psychedelic drugs like psilocybin, but somehow you're just stripping out the hallucinogenic effect? The molecule is actually quite similar?
Yeah, so structurally, that's kind of been our approach, at least at the start. So at the start, we wanted to use molecules that had demonstrated clinical efficacy, like psilocybin, like ketamine, like MDMA, and then just make small tweaks to their chemical structures to remove the hallucinogenic effects. However, the way that medicinal chemistry works, it's a lot like chemical evolution. And by making systematic changes in the structure of the molecule, you can refine it to the various purposes that you're intending. And so if we start with the structures of psychedelics, we can chemically evolve them into something that doesn't look anything like a psychedelic, but will have some of the similar effects on structural neuroplasticity.
Hmm. Is this hard to do? I mean, is it? I mean, in the lab, is this like a really complicated process to try to create these molecules and to take out the hallucinogenic properties?
Well, I think this is why medicinal chemists will always have a job. They have job security.
And the medical model here? It's completely different than how psychedelic therapy works right now, which typically involves spending hours and hours with facilitators before, during, and after a trip.
The goal is to create medicines that are safe enough that you can go to the local pharmacy, pick them up, and store them in your medicine cabinet. And how frequently you have to take the pill, whether that's once a week, once a month, once a year, time will tell. But it will not be the traditional SSRI type model. Now you can start thinking about taking one of those drugs and interacting with a therapist in a virtual environment over Zoom or something like that. That would eliminate the need to go to the clinic. But I do imagine that there will be kind of this treatment hierarchy where at the base of this treatment pyramid, you'll start with the most scalable medicines, which will be the take-home drugs, where that's all you need. And if patients get better, fantastic. And if they don't, they can start to move up the pyramid where we append other things like psychotherapy or like an in-clinic hallucinogenic experience.
So far, the research to engineer these psychoplastogens has largely been done on mice, but there's only so much you can learn about a psychedelic drug, hallucinogenic or not, from a mouse brain. And this is where David Olson's biotech company comes in.
So let me ask you a little bit about Delix, the company that you have co-founded that is doing this research, developing products. I believe you have over $100 million in venture capital already put into the company, right?
Yes, that's correct. Delix has been very successful in their fundraising efforts to this point.
And what's your timeline? I mean, I realize this is basic research, it's difficult research, but do you have any sense of when you will start to see results or when you might have some drugs that will come on the market?
Yeah, so a lot of people think of Delix as the company that's taken the fun out of fungi. They're the non-hallucinogenic psychoplastogen company. But right now, what's very exciting is they've been able to take the first non-hallucinogenic psychoplastogen into people. Now the question is, will it be effective? And honestly, that question will not be answered for a very long time. And so this is going to take years and years of clinical work, very hard clinical work.
How many years, if things go well?
Typical drug discovery is a 20-year process.
Oh, wow.
And we've been moving pretty quickly. So that usually comes from a lot of the preclinical testing all the way through the safety studies, through the phase one, and then you do all of the clinical work. We're hoping it's not going to take us 20 years to get to this, but to get to our first question of efficacy in the first patient population that we're looking at, that should take a few more years.
Now, it seems like a lot is riding on your work. I mean, literally, billions of dollars. The psychedelic industry is booming. It's taking off. There are a lot of startups. This will become, if it's not already, a multi-billion dollar industry. And if we're talking about being able to deliver the therapeutic effects without having to do the big trip, the big experience, that will totally take the psychedelic industry in another direction, correct?
Well, I you know, you point out the large figures in dollars, but you have to realize that those dollars come from the large number of patients. We're talking about a billion people worldwide that suffer from some kind of mental illness that might be impacted by psychoplastogenic drugs. That is really what I'm focused on, is trying to reach the largest patient population that we can. Now, psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy is incredible because it's taking the field in a completely new direction, one that is more similar to a healing-based approach than simply mitigating disease symptoms. But if that is the only way to reap the benefit of these molecules, it would be a very, very sad day for this world, because only a subset of very fortunate individuals would be able to access that type of treatment. But with the non-hallucinogenic psychoplastogens, we hopefully can broaden that to the enormous number of people who are impacted by mental health conditions every day.
That's David Olson, director of the UC Davis Institute for Psychedelics and Neurotherapeutics, and also the co-founder of the biotech company Delix Therapeutics.